from present-day Bangladesh to Myanmar's Rakhine State during the 17th century. When Myanmar won freedom from British colonialism in 1948, the members of the ethnic community were left stranded in the Rakhine State, denied citizenship under the country's 1982 citizenship law, and seen as outsiders. It fueled discrimination against the Rohingya Muslims and exposed them to state-sanctioned persecution and genocide. Their migration continued for several years, but in August 2017, the Burmese junta unleashed a ruthless crackdown on them. The savagery, including gang rapes, cold-blooded murders, torture, and destruction of properties, was widely documented by human rights bodies, drawing global outrage. Soldiers were accused of what many world leaders and rights groups dubbed ethnic cleansing. However, Myanmar's then civilian leader and Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi refused to blame the army. No one was held accountable for the brazen acts of genocide and crimes against humanity. Activists maintain that to facilitate the return of Rohingya Muslims to their homeland, the Burmese military rulers must dismantle the structures of apartheid and discriminatory laws against Rohingya Muslims and stop obstructing international initiatives to investigate what happened in Rakhine.
Now to have more insights, we are joined by Mrs. Sharifa Shakira, Program Associate at Justice for All, Burma Task Force and founder of Rohingya Women Development Network from Houston, Texas. First of all, welcome to the program, Mrs. Shakira. Now it's been 5 years since the genocide and the subsequent displacement of the Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar. Now can you tell us very briefly how the exodus began?
We, the Rohingya people, have been facing genocide since Myanmar's independence, and it has effectively been going on since 1978. Since then, our citizenship was confiscated from us, our rights on education was confiscated from us, our movement was restricted, our people were tortured, killed, murdered, and all of this, it's been taking place is because of our ethnicity, which is Rohingya, as well as our religion, which is Muslim, and of course because of the land as well. And today, because of the genocide that has been taking place for many, many decades, we ended up living in world largest refugee camp in Bangladesh, with more than 1.1 million people in Bangladesh camp living with living in a limbo with no education, no security, no livelihood, and so on. And we only left with about 600,000 inside the Myanmar, and the rest are everywhere in the world fighting and hoping to be recognized as Rohingya from Burma and to be considered as a citizen and to be given back our rights was confiscated from us, which is our citizen. And we are hoping that one day, inshallah, we can go home as a Rohingya from Burma.
Mrs. Shakira, the UN described the state-sponsored carnage in Rakhine as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. So how did the military and civilian rulers get away with it?
United Nations neither have the power nor wills to do anything against the genocide by the Myanmar military, informal civilians government led by Aung San Suu Kyi. United Nations could call for international sanctions, but it would not be effective.
Mr. Shakira, Bangladesh wants the repatriation of the Rohingya refugees, while the top UN human rights official says the situation in Myanmar still isn't safe enough for their return. So what can be done in such a situation?
Not only Bangladesh would like to repatriate Rohingya, but Rohingya refugees themselves would like to return home at the same time. And it is equally true that the Rakhine State in Myanmar are not completely safe enough for the refugees to return home. It is because there are two powerful armies, armed groups, that fighting each other over the control, which is the Myanmar military and Rakhine army. And between both of them, Rohingya inside are becoming the human shells. And it also true that there is no exact information where Rohingya will be settled after they returning home, because their homes, villages was completely erased by the Myanmar government. In these situations, the international community and the world citizens need to engage all the parties involved, including Myanmar military, China, Bangladesh, as well as Rohingya, to find a long-lasting solutions.
On that note, I would like to thank Mrs. Shakira, Program Associate at Justice for All, Burma Task Force, and founder of Rohingya Women Development Network from Houston, Texas. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
George Laria, J. Regional Director of UNICEF South Asia, says about 500,000 Rohingya refugee children have been for the past 5 years living in exile in the refugee camps of Bangladesh. Rohingya activist Aung Kyaw Mo reports about demonstrations by Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh to mark 5 years of their mass exodus and to demand safe, dignified, and voluntary repatriation to Myanmar. Jan Egeland, Secretary General of Norwegian Refugee Council, notes that Rohingya refugees were forced out of their ancestral land, adding that history will punish us if we do not make their safe, dignified, and voluntary return possible.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The controversial move by the Indian government to allow voting rights to non-locals in the contested Himalayan region of Kashmir has drawn anger and outrage from locals who see it as yet another attempt to alter the region's Muslim-majority character. According to the plan, any Indian citizen living temporarily in Indian-controlled Kashmir can vote now, which local population and the political parties see it as a move to permanently disenfranchise, disempower and dispossess Kashmiris and change the region's demography.
The controversial move was announced in August by the federally governed territory's top electoral officer, riling up local political parties as well as mainland India's political opposition. The decision will see about 2.5 million voters added to 7.6 million voters already existing, marking a massive 30% rise. The new voters would include those temporarily living in the region, including military personnel, government and private sector employees, as well as migrant workers. The decision has been blasted by Kashmir-based political parties and main opposition parties in New Delhi. Mehbooba Mufti, a former chief minister of the Himalayan region and a former ally of the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, slammed the move as the last nail in the coffin of electoral democracy in the region. She accused the Narendra Modi government in New Delhi of fraudulently bringing 2.5 million voters and applying Israeli policy in the Muslim-majority region.
We are Kashmiri people. To us, Hindu and Muslim make no difference. We always want them to return and stay alongside Muslims. We are secure with each other.
Omar Abdullah, another former chief minister of the region, accused the Modi government in New Delhi of importing voters to win elections. The People's Alliance for Gupkar Declaration, a political alliance of several regional political parties, has termed the decision unacceptable and warned to go to court. Some Hindu parties have also joined the campaign against the BJP government's latest move.
The latest move by the BJP government in Kashmir follows a series of similar measures in the past 3 years since the abrogation of the region's semi-autonomous status in deeply controversial circumstances. Article 35A of the Indian Constitution was central to Article 370, which established the quasi-autonomous relationship between New Delhi and Kashmir and barred non-locals from owning immovable property or exercising political rights in the region. The revocation of Article 370 paved the road for other similar and controversial measures.
Until August 2019, when the BJP government in New Delhi revoked Jammu and Kashmir's special status by abrogating Article 370 and 35A, voting rights in the region were given only to permanent residents. Article 370 of the Indian Constitution barred people from mainland India from permanently settling in Kashmir, buying land, or holding local government jobs there. On August 5, 2019, Narendra Modi's government unilaterally stripped the region of its special status, setting up a series of similar laws that observers say aimed to change the region's demography. Among the controversial moves was the domicile law that grants citizenship rights to every Indian living in the region for more than 15 years, as well as a law that makes every Indian citizen eligible to buy land in the region.
Autonomy is the best option, if somebody would ask me. More autonomy to the people of Kashmir. Fair elections. Send back forces to barracks, number one. Number two, reach out to the separatists, reach out to the youths, reach out to the common man.
Importantly, the decision to grant voting rights to non-Kashmiris comes after the controversial delimitation exercise, which sparked anger and outrage in the region, as Jammu with less population got 6 additional seats, while Kashmir with more population got only 1 additional seat. People in Kashmir saw the move skewed in favor of the Hindu-majority Jammu. According to the 2000 census of the 12.5 million population in Kashmir, Muslims comprised 68.31% and Hindus 28.43%. More than 7 million of these residents live in Kashmir.
Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Dr. Mohammed Junaid. He teaches anthropology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. He is also a Kashmiri writer whose work on military occupation, politics and memory in Kashmir has appeared in a number of journals, magazines and books. Now, first of all, welcome to the program, Dr. Junaid. Now, the Indian government's decision to give voting rights to non-local Kashmiris has again stirred up controversy and drawn outrage. Now, do you see it as yet another attempt to change the Muslim-majority region's demography?
So, according to Indian election officials in Kashmir, close to 2.5 million Indians who come to Kashmir or who have stayed in Kashmir for a while and decide to vote in the local elections, not the national elections or Indian elections, but the local elections, they will have the right to vote. 2.5 million people is close to 20% of the entire voting population of the state of Jammu and Kashmir. This is a massive shift in terms of how elections have been held in Kashmir over the last 7 decades. We know the history of elections or democracy in Kashmir has always been suspect. There have been rigged elections, people have been chosen or forced to not contest. Now, parties that were close to winning, they were basically forced to accept defeats. The voting agents were tortured and whatnot. And Kashmiris have often lost confidence in the Indian electoral system, because the primary goal for Indian security agencies with regard to elections is not democracy, is not to give voice to the people of Kashmir, but to make sure that they have a pliant regime in power there. So this 2.5 million people that are going to be added overnight to the electoral rolls means that the ruling regime in India, led by BJP, they will be the beneficiaries, because they are going to make sure that they give voting rights to those people who vote for their party. Now, the ultimate goal is that since 2019, when India revoked the so-called autonomy in Kashmir and did away with Articles 370 and 35A, it needs some kind of endorsement from the Kashmiri public, because the case is in India's Supreme Court, and it wants to make sure that that Kashmiri people are supportive of this. Of course, Kashmiris are not supportive of the changes that took place, but the BJP wants to manufacture that consent now. So that's why they want a pliant regime in Kashmir, particularly led by its own party, that will kind of endorse the 2019 decisions.
Dr. Junaid, Kashmiri political outfits as well as India's opposition parties have condemned New Delhi's latest move in Kashmir. One Kashmiri politician equated it with Israel's policy in Palestine. Now, do you find the parallels striking?
This is happening in the overall sort of context of India trying to take away not only the, rights of Kashmiris to their land, but to sort of change the dynamics of the 7-decade-old conflict by kind of forced demographic alteration. This is not new, of course. Globally, it has taken place. Dominant states, settler states, have sought to demographically alter situations for indigenous peoples. By changing the facts on the ground, the Indian government wants to sort of alter the conversation altogether, because so far Kashmiris have been talking about their own sovereignty and the unhealed scars of the 1947 partition that left Kashmiris in a limbo. But now India wants to turn it into a sort of a Hindu-Muslim conflict, where the settlers, mostly Hindu from India, would have a privileged existence in Kashmir as compared to the historic population of Kashmiri Muslims and Kashmiri Hindus, which is a small minority of the population, who would sort of be at the mercy of this large new settler population backed by a huge Indian army, which is already kind of present in Kashmir. These tactics are, of course, Indian government officials often talk about this in terms of, sort of making sure that they have a nationalist population in Kashmir. So they're trying to introduce a new population, which is not different from what the United States did, for instance, in its colonies, or what Israel is doing in Palestine, what British did in Australia and New Zealand and so many other places.
Last but not least, sir, is it fair to say that the space for pro-freedom groups and civil society shrunk in the Himalayan region due to India's massive crackdown after the events of August 2019?
So this is a very dangerous new situation that Kashmiris are in. In terms of, the elections, also we have to remember that there has not been an elected assembly. Kashmiri, as I said, they don't vote too much in the elections, but there was sort of an assembly in place in until 2018. And that was dissolved then. It's also interesting because while people are talking about elections, the assembly that might be elected would have very little powers. I know Kashmir is no longer a state now. It's a union territory, and some of the major institutions in the state, like the police, the home ministry, and education, and so many other areas, are directly now controlled by India's federal home ministry. So the whatever body is going to be elected will have very limited say. My sense is that the goal is to have a rubber stamp authority in Kashmir, whose only purpose would be to endorse the August 5, 2019 decision of the Indian government. So whatever elections happen would not alter the situation of Kashmiris. It would simply endorse what is the fact on the ground right now.
On that note, I would like to thank Dr. Mohammed Junaid. He teaches anthropology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts in North Adams, Massachusetts. He is also a Kashmiri writer whose work on military occupation, politics and memory in Kashmir has appeared in a number of journals, magazines and books. Thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Novelist, poet and activist Meena Kandasamy quotes former Kashmir Chief Minister Mehbooba Mufti slamming the move to give non-local Kashmiris voting rights as the last nail in the coffin of electoral democracy in the region. Anis Sargar, a Kashmir-based journalist, reports on the all-party meet called in protests against Indian government's move to allow non-locals voting rights, which has triggered fears of demographic change among locals. Kashmiri political activist Farooq Rehmani terms the move to give voting rights to non-locals in Kashmir as a predetermined settler policy, equating it with Israeli plans in occupied Palestinian territories.
And that was our episode about the plight of Rohingya Muslim refugees persecuted at home and disowned abroad, and also the Indian government's continued attempts to change Kashmir's demography. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRabi English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. There are fascinating points in Munajat al-Shakin, which is part of Munajat Khams al-Ashar by Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam. This is the Munajat of the complaints. Of course, Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam in this whisper prayer does not complain about God. His main complaints are about two things. One is about nafs or carnal soul, and another is about the Satan. In this munajat we read, O Allah, I complain to you of a soul committing to evil, rushing to offenses, eager to disobey you, and exposing itself to your anger. It takes me on the roads of disasters. It makes me the easiest of perishers before you, full of heedlessness and inattention. It hurries me to misdeeds.
O
خدای من پیش تو گلم رو دارم میارم از نفسی که به سوء اماره همش منو امر میکنه به بدی.
In these fragments of Munajat al-Shakin, Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam complains about his carnal soul, which leads him towards the evil and paves the way for committing more sins and errors. This is the carnal soul that postpones doing good and facilitates doing evil. The carnal soul, according to Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam, is after play and diversion, and establishes ignorance in a person. It is eager to disobey Allah and is never satisfied. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hojjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The new U.S. Defense Department plan called Civilian Harm Mitigation and Response Action Plan, which promises killing less innocent people in wars, seems to be sanitizing the brutality of American endless wars rather than announcing these interventions illegitimate. This plan tries to humanize the American wars around the world and their consequences. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay with us, please. The website of Responsible Statecraft wrote, "A few days ago, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin announced the completion of a civilian harm mitigation and response action plan, promising institutional changes so that American war making kills fewer innocent people. The plan is a clear step forward in the humanization of endless war, the ethically fraught project attempt to spotlight in the book Humane, how the United States abandoned peace and reinvented war, which appeared a year ago in a paperback edition. The Pentagon commitment and the dynamics that led to it fit well with some of arguments in the book. While making American war less brutal is an uplifting project when it works, it can also function by intentional design to create a new kind of war that results in greater legitimacy. The plan is entirely open about this. It begins, "The protection of civilians is a strategic priority as well as a moral imperative." Abetted by critical outsiders and sympathetic insiders who decry the brutality rather than existence of wars, humanizing war reflects ethical progress in the fighting of American war while entrenching its performance. According to Responsible Statecraft, historically, humanitarian activists have been dramatizing civilian harm for decades, and with a special intensity since the so-called War on Terror began after September 11, 2001. But when the order to develop an action plan came down in January, it was clearly in response to the extraordinary Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporting led by Azmat Khan, which gave unprecedented visibility to the cost of American war-making on civilians by documenting the extraordinary levels of casualties in air strikes. As a New York Times editor observed, military officials credited the work of Azmat and other Times journalists who rigorously reported on this project as important factors in driving change. And it is, no doubt, quite an accomplishment to prompt that transformation. As the plan explains, reforms will bring more concern for harm to military culture and organization. Read carefully. The plan amounts for now to a set of promises to hire more people at a Pentagon and in combatant commands to raise consciousness in hopes of further remaking American war in the crucible of care. The plan will also provide a hub for information gathering about far-flung operations conducted across service branches. The military, it says, should even consider acknowledging the episodes when it causes too much death and injury. The overall goal is to mainstream ethical compassion in American military operations without disturbing the eternal and necessary project of putting civilians in harm's way. But while good might come of it, for sure, more is at stake in such mainstreaming. The plan is being called sweeping by Khan and other New York Times journalists and welcomed as a great leap forward. The Defense Department finally prioritizes civilians in conflict, one prominent targeting professional put it. Of course, there is a lot to be desired in the plan even before attempts to implement it get underway. A triumph of bureaucratic newspeak, there will be a center of excellence for civilian casualties. The document that announces it and spells out some of the details leaves lots of room for maneuver when it comes to follow through. And it does not seem to apply to the Central Intelligence Agency, which pioneered drone strikes and continues to conduct them, as in the recent killing of Al-Qaeda leader. The website of Common Dreams also wrote, perhaps most glaringly on its own terms, the plan says nothing about the international law governing the conduct of hostilities, and low essential rethinking the American interpretation of it clearly is. Indeed, the January press release announcing the reform process presents the United States as already operating in line with its legal obligations not to kill too many civilians on a strong foundation of compliance with the law umbrella of armed conflict, but questioning whether the reforms pan out or whether they someday come to guarantee even more humanity in warfare misses the bigger point, which is that the humanization of war can work to legitimate war, especially when it works. When it comes from the Pentagon, indeed, that is the point. As we narrate in Humane, the humanization of American war dates from the aftermath of the Vietnam War, precisely when the international law requiring humanitarian care in the conduct of hostilities took its own great leap forward. The American story has been driven from the first by the alliance of critical outsiders composed of activists, journalists, and lawyers with sympathetic insiders within government and military. Across a considerable divide, they bicker over how far to go in making ongoing war more humane against the background of ongoing American militarism, even as questions about whether, where, and how long war is fought are relegated to the margins. According to Common Dreams, outsiders focusing selectively on brutality and especially civilian harm join a growing constituency of insiders within the military that hope to redefine the warrior's honor while managing public relations in the face of atrocious excesses. There could hardly be better proof of how these two forces work together in producing a relatively more humanized form of ongoing war than the new plan. The results are a good thing if the choice is between relatively more brutal and relatively less brutal war. But from the perspective of old and new calls for restraint in starting wars or fighting them forever, that is not always the choice. Humanitarians are characteristically silent about the justice or legality of war itself, while journalists also generally restrict themselves to factual proof of atrocity even when it takes place in the midst of aggressive war. For example, the path-breaking New York Times series on civilian harm, which dealt substantially with the war against Daesh in Syria, nowhere took up that war is generally regarded as illegal as such under international law, quite apart from its civilian harm. So there is a risk that the new reforms will abet a dynamic described in the first 20 years of GWOT. Questions related to the justice, propriety, and legality of America's gargantuan military footprint were sidelined as the efforts were rendered a little less offensive in some of their human cost. The plan makes more of the same possible. And while Biden followed through on Trump's withdrawal from Afghanistan, he has re-engaged with the special forces in Somalia, where drones have also been deployed in operations. Overall, there may be less American war for the moment, leaving aside the forms of support for Ukraine. But it would be wishful thinking to conclude that any controls have been placed on the ongoing war posture, especially since Biden's move have come along with doubling down on Trump's confrontational position towards China. The Pentagon's promise of more humane war has to be put in that context. The controls that seem available concern how future wars are going to be fought, not whether a culture of restraint in fighting them at all ever takes root.
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Toward the peak. on Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station.
Islamite, Allah my Lord, Allah my Lord, His word Quran, His word Quran, Muhammad, Prophet, Muhammad, Prophet, praise be upon, praise be upon, I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners and audiences, brothers and sisters from all around the world, you're hearing my voice from Youth Station. I am Bita at your service, and with me, there is my precious friend.
Oh my God, thank you.
Sister Asma.
Assalamu alaikum, Bita.
Assalamu alaikum.
What's the new topic? Tell me.
Our topic is about the condition. How condition will affect you and your decisions. Yeah. What will you do when the condition is in a way that you will do something that you don't do?
Condition has a sorrowful connotation for me. I don't know why.
Why?
Because most of the time when there is condition, there comes forceful situation that you have to make decisions unlike your will and wish. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly.
And of course you have experienced that because as a human being who is living this life, which is a cauldron of problems and mixed emotions, you would come to a situation in which you have to call it a condition.
The thing is, as you know, the life is always in a continuous change.
Yeah.
There is a beautiful quote that says, "Adahr yawman yawma laka wa yawma alayka."
Very beautiful.
You know, I think the life is a test. One day is for you, one day is against you. No matter what it is, you have to find yourself in this road. You have to find it. And religion is the best way for you to find yourself, to go through this road and to be certain that what you choose is true and is reliable.
But you know, Bita, when talking to the youth, imagine you're talking to a 15-year-old or, I don't know, 18-year-old boy or girl. If you tell them that, okay, religion is the best way for you to find goal, it's going to be sort of very, they're going to give you that eye, which means, okay, what do you mean?
I know what you mean.
So practicing this sentence is very difficult. Sometimes we are put in a situation which is very difficult. I feel like the entire world is collapsing around me. I feel like I'm devastated. And there is nothing that I can help myself with.
You know, I think we are all humans, and human is to err. There are situations that you're not able to do anything, and you will make many mistakes. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The thing is, you have to always be aware of your mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, there are people, like, for example, they make mistakes and then say, okay, it was true. It was the thing I believe is so is true, and you cannot do anything about it because this person has prejudice, has a special belief in something which is not true.
Yeah.
And you cannot do anything about it. But I think if you want to change the world, you have to change yourself. And
of course,
starting from yourself is the
best
way.
But what about when condition is going to change me?
Condition is not going to change you. You have to change the condition.
Of course it would. It would.
I know.
Trust me, it would.
I trust you, actually. I experienced it. I don't want to deny the fact that condition is a big factor in my decisions.
Imagine, you are put in a situation where you have to decide to be a liar or a truthful, honest person. You're put in a situation where you have to say the truth, but the truth is going to turn your life upside down. So it's very difficult to stay the same honest, perfect person you have always
been. Even imagining this situation is a pain in the neck.
But
the thing is, when you decide,
in your life, in your lifetime, that I want to be an honest person, no matter what effect it has, no matter what are the conclusions, no matter how my life will be affected by this decision, I will be honest because I believe honesty is a part of humanity. I believe honesty is a part of me. I won't change my decision.
But trust me, Bita, sometimes there would come a situation in which you really don't know that this lie is going to make you a liar. Sometimes you think what you are doing is just to protect yourself. It's a white lie.
I know.
We used to whitewash things, you know? Exactly. We call them, what they call it, innocent lie. So we are just giving an example. It could be applied to different sort of other problems. What I believe in is that situations sometimes do change us. We turn out to be some different human beings at some certain points. And it is unbelievably out of control sometimes.
I know what you mean. You know, every moment you're not the same person that you were in the last moment.
Yeah.
Even right now, you're not after, for example, talking to me or talking to anyone, you're not the same person. Up to here, we talked about the effect of condition on your decisions and on what you're going to do in this situation when you cannot decide whether I have to be a good person, the perfect person that I want to be, or I have to change my opinion because that will affect my life and I will change it. And what are the reasons or something?
And of course, there's more to that.
Exactly.
Which is going to come after?
After a break.
Yes.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back to Youth Station. We're talking about the effect of condition and how you decide in your life.
Yeah, the sorrowful word of condition.
Yeah, you don't like it.
Yes,
I can see the sorrowness in your eyes, how you hate and detest this word.
Yes.
But the thing is, you cannot change something. You cannot change your feeling about condition.
Yeah. Of course, there are some good conditions as well, but mostly what happens to human being is sad conditions. They have to turn it all around.
You know, we cannot define a special condition as sad or good or something. It depends on your opinion. It depends on
your perspective.
Exactly. And because of that, I think we cannot resist this change. We have to just accept it sometimes, and we have to go through this flow of life.
Yeah. Bita, there's a quote, since you're very much interested in quotes, which is very common, and I love it. It says that, I'm going to give the gist. It's not going to be the authentic one. Mm-hmm. It says that once a person is going to go into a storm, the one who's coming out of that storm is no longer the same person. So it's the situation with conditions.
You know, your quote reminded me of something. It was like, you cannot be a good sailor when you don't go through the storm.
Yeah.
So you cannot,
they say that a silent sea does not make a perfect sailor.
Exactly. So you have to go through it sometimes. And it's not a bad thing.
But what about when this stormy sea is going to make a beast out of me?
You know what? You're talking like, okay, I can do nothing and this storm will do anything to me.
I'm talking about these stormy situations in which they are much more stronger than you. You know, let me tell you something. We all know about the tragic story of the battlefield of Karbala. And what happened to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. I usually believe that what happened to people in there was a moment of decision.
Exactly.
You know, it's just in a moment you flip it all around. You decide to be the bad guy. And it's your decision. You don't know that you're making a decision which is going to make a beast out of you, but you are making that and you are responsible for it.
I know what you say because I always, when I think about the event of Karbala and Ashura, it's like, what would I do if I were there? You know? I don't know myself.
Because usually
scary.
Very scary. I'm very happy to hear that from you because it needs courage to confess that, you know? It's scary to be in their place.
Because, you know, right now I'm sitting here and I'm saying I'm Muslim, I believe in Allah, I like Imam Hussein or something. But I'm not sure if I was there, what would I do?
Yeah, very true. See, we have our hidden Imam, Imam Mahdi ajalallah farajah, and he has been promised to come one day. And still, we do not know what happens if he comes. What would I be?
Exactly.
Would I side with his enemies? Would it be ever possible for me to side with his enemies against him? You know that I claim that I love him with my full heart?
Exactly, because we're not aware of what we can be, the beast that you were talking about.
That's
this
the thing.
Is it.
We do not know where life is going to take us.
But the thing is, we cannot just sit here and fear that situation that we're not even aware of.
So what we can do for it?
I think we have to just value our moments. Right now I'm here, I'm talking to you, I'm thinking this is valuable. And when you value it, after a while, your brain will help you to...
And Bita, the most important thing, according to me, for as a solution for that is to set some rules and borders for yourself.
Exactly.
As a human being, you should have a school of thought.
This is religion, you know?
Yeah.
There
are
guidelines. And you told me that if, for example, a 15-year-old boy or girl was here, how would you, for example, explain that, okay, you have to choose religion because it's the best way? It is exactly the process that we have to go through.
I just said that you cannot say it directly. When you say, you know, because people have guards, they are on their guards when you talk about religion. But when you tell them, okay, sets of rules, they're going to like it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's what happened to human beings.
For example, when you say there are some guidelines that are set here and you have to go through them, they're like, no, I don't like to do that because I have my own opinions.
They want to be the masters of their life.
Exactly. But actually, we are servants. And at last, we have to accept it.
Very truly put. Yes, we are servants. We should come to this conclusion that we are servants of Allah. And we have to be obedient to him.
Exactly.
And this obedience must come through love, not force. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. I know what you mean. And as you told me, we are servants. And the God told us, I am your best master. You have to trust me. And you have to find this trust in your life to be against the condition will make you.
You should chain the beast that lives inside of you. And that chaining thing, that chaining process comes through prayers, comes through obedience, comes through, connection to Allah.
Exactly.
And then he would make everything easier.
So, at least I want to say that we are servants of Allah and this is a big gift and we're blessed by that gift.
So, no matter what conditions you're in, try to invest all your trust in him and he would finally... make you find a way out of it.
Exactly. Okay, so we talked about conditions and being a good servant for Allah. It was a nice conversation with Sister Asma.
Of course,
and I wish
you,
all audiences, enjoyed our conversation. This is the last of the program. This is RIB English Radio. Thank you for listening. Under another session, I leave you in the warm embrace of God. May God bless you.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator. My Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker, abiding in silence with patience and guidance. Aware when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgive. the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.